This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar by Shep Rose. Read by the author.
For Josh Adams, Randy Light, and Jane Furtado. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Shakespeare. Hobbes. So the secret to good self-esteem is to lower your expectations to the point where they're already met. Calvin. Right. We should take pride in our mediocrity. Introduction. Welcome to Shepland. Writing requires discipline. It means you're sitting alone for long periods of time instead of being out there in the world having fun, with a babe on one side, a beer or two on the other, or a babe on each side holding a beer for you, or two babes on each side, well, you get the picture. So why the hell am I doing this? I had it made. As I write this, I'm entering the seventh season of filming Southern Charm. I've got a few side investments in companies, or hustles, if you want to make it sound all culturally relevant and cool. I was happy and lazy sitting on the beach in Charleston living in Shepland, which is a magical place devoid of stress and full of beer and good times. The name came from an older guy who owned a pizza place in my hometown, for which I was a delivery boy, and he made it up in honor of yours truly. In Shepland, nothing matters and there are no consequences. Everything just seems to work out, and being blissfully average is the goal. I spent my entire life there, lowering the bar, with very few interruptions, until now. So why make the choice to suddenly give myself deadlines and responsibility and work? Being on reality TV means that strangers might know my name, or they might call me an asshole on social media. That's when you really know you've made it. But it doesn't exactly mean I'm sitting atop the television industry as far as prestige goes. It's not like people confuse Shep Rose with Daniel Day-Lewis. On second thought, maybe I am the Daniel Day-Lewis of reality TV. Someone so deep into character that the character is me. Plus, I have had a pretty darn good education for someone who strives for blissful mediocrity. I refuse to rest on my laurels, though, as mildly impressive as they are. In any case, damn it, it's high time I put pen to paper before my life stories are swept into the dustbin of time. That would be a tragedy, as you'll see when you hopefully continue listening to this book. Never in a million years did I envision that I'd be on a show like Southern Charm. I never imagined I would work in entertainment at all. You see, in the South, where I was born and bred and still live, you'd literally get laughed off the screened-in porch if you said you were going to try to make it in Hollywood. Even hinting at a minuscule interest in theater was met with a skeptical side eye. It was generally accepted and expected that you grow up to be a banker, a lawyer, a doctor, or a real estate magnate. My family is full of esteemed people who were way above average. A great aunt who was the first female athlete on the cover of Time magazine, grandfathers and uncles who were decorated soldiers or revered business people, lawyers, and politicians who mingled with world leaders. And then there's me, Shep, reality TV personality and all-around average guy. Although being average isn't so bad, as I'll prove in this book. Is there an alternate universe where I'm an investment banker? I mean, it wouldn't have been that unlikely, considering how I grew up. If I had become a banker or lawyer, I would have basically been playing a role in a movie. At least on Southern Charm, I can just be Shep. In my 20s, I went down that road for a minute, but I had an epiphany on a trip to Hong Kong, more on that later, and realized that I would never be the guy in the suit saddled with responsibility, tied down, and having zero fun. Around that time, one of my dad's friends told me that nothing matters before you're 30. So I've just stretched that to 40. Maybe I'll push it to 50. Right now, I'm just a guy out there in the world trying to amuse himself. It's not a bad role to play, but it pisses some people off. Typically the misery loves company sort. I went to school with varying degrees of success. I was a straight B student. I studied the night before and pretty much skated by, and eventually my parents learned that I had what you'd call a behavioral problem. You see, I may have been patient zero for ADD and ADHD. I forgot which one I had slash have, which is classic ADD, ADHD. When I was in fourth grade, my family was living in Alexandria, Virginia, because my dad was working for the Reagan administration. Again, above average. And my mom and my teachers agreed that I might need to be examined by some behavioral specialists. My mom took me to a doctor, and they put me in a room with a table and a chair and told me to take a test. Little did I know there was a two-way mirror behind which I'm assuming sat Manhattan Project caliber scientists, watching and studying little Shep, mouths agape at what they were witnessing. After the allotted hour, my mom was asked to talk to the lead scientist, aka child psychologist. Just for some context, this was around 1988, so Ritalin was in its infancy and was being wildly overprescribed. So the good doctor pulls my mom aside, and this is what ensues. Doctor, we have good news and bad news. Mom, tell me the good news first. Doctor, he did very well on the test. Mom, and the bad news? Doctor, he laid on his back on the floor underneath the table with the test stuck to the underside of the metal table. We have never seen anyone take a test that way before. This might actually be my first taste of stardom. I was going to be featured in medical journals around the world. After the test, I was prescribed what the legendary drug-loving drummer Levon Helm would call an adult portion of Ritalin to take before school. Don't get me wrong. The drug did help me focus, but I hated who it turned me into. My whole personality changed. At first, the teachers were probably relieved to have a mild-mannered child in their class instead of a hellion. But then I think they started to have second thoughts. I distinctly remember my sixth grade math class being right before lunch. I refused to leave the classroom unless I understood everything that the teacher had just spent the last hour teaching. Plus, I would argue and question everything she said. I'm sure the poor woman just wanted to have a cigarette and a sandwich, but I wouldn't leave. At least without Ritalin, I would have given the teacher a break. When I finally did leave for lunch, I would walk into the cafeteria and my friends would call me over to sit with them. And totally out of character for a social butterfly troublemaker like myself, I wouldn't, or rather couldn't. I would sit by myself and not eat my lunch. Actually, I would just eat the shark bite fruit snacks in my lunchbox. Saving the great whites for last, of course. Because in addition to robbing me of my charisma, the Ritalin also robbed me of hunger. I was irritated by my friends, highly antisocial, and unable to inhabit Shepland. I hated the drug and stopped taking it in high school, where I resumed my normal activities of raising hell and having fun. Signs of my innate rebelliousness, nonconformity, and burgeoning averageness were everywhere from the very start. My poor mom probably wasn't surprised by any doctor's observations or diagnoses. When I was just 2 years old, there was a series of incidents that were harbingers of things to come. For one thing, my parents had to lock me inside the house or I'd escape. I had just learned to walk and apparently had places to go and people to see, and in one case, garden utensils to steal. One day, a friend of my mom's came over and my mom forgot to lock the door, and so I plotted my escape and toddled out of the house undetected. My mom and her friend frantically ran around outside screaming my name until they spotted me dragging a rake and a hoe down the street. I guess I had gone into a neighbor's garage and absconded with some tools to assist with my developing green thumb. Or maybe I just wanted to dig some holes and create havoc. My mom was too embarrassed to knock on doors and return the tools, so she just left them leaning against the neighbor's mailboxes and took me home. If you were a Rose neighbor circa 1982 through 1995, please submit a detailed financial breakdown of what I owe you, and Simon & Schuster will reimburse you directly. Another time, my grandmother was visiting and she left the back door open. You see where this is going. The back door opened up to a fairway on a golf course, which we all know is extremely dangerous terrain. Alligators, wayward heat-seeking golf balls, etc. Anyway, there were some roofers at our house fixing shingles that day. My mom and grandmother couldn't find me anywhere until some golfers came screaming up our lawn, saying they spied a tiny person on top of the house. I was sitting cross-legged on the roof, laughing my little ass off, staring certain death in the face. The roofers must have been on a lunch break. How I got up there, I have no idea. I've always been wily, and to be honest, I'm impressed with my 2-year-old self for his acrobatic antics. The final story, or maybe the last one my mom is willing to tell before she bursts into retroactive tears from all the anxiety I caused, is when I was almost 3 years old and she walked into the kitchen and I had somehow climbed on top of the refrigerator. I literally had my hands in the cookie jar. As my mom tells it, we locked eyes, then I screamed and jumped off the fridge from 6 feet up, landing on my feet and running into the living room to hide underneath the couch. Because I hadn't hurt myself leaping off the fridge, my mom was too shocked to punish me. In many ways, I have never changed. I made a conscious decision back then to remain that kid leaping off the fridge and courting middling danger at every turn. And so far, I've been pretty successful. My mom always thought I was like the kid from Where the Wild Things Are, but I always felt more like Calvin from the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes. He was my earliest hero. He was analytical and cynical. He had untapped potential, meaning he hovered around mediocrity on a daily basis, like me, a hatred for authority, and a mischievous streak. Bill Watterson, who created the comic, said of Calvin, "I wouldn't want Calvin in my house, but on paper he helps me sort through my life and understand it." I think he was giving Calvin a compliment. My mom looked at me early on and said, "If you can't beat him, join him." She bought me every Calvin and Hobbes comic, probably because she related to Calvin's mom. That comic actually taught me more than I learned in school in some ways. My mom helped foster my rebellious spirit and taught me ways to channel it into more thought-provoking contrarianism rather than lawless and dangerous behavior. I've always been acutely aware of the difference between right and wrong, and I always felt like my mom and dad and grandparents were watching, and I dare not embarrass them, at least not too much. Since I was a toddler, I guess, I've had a deep respect for renegades, contrarians, and disruptors. People who didn't care about social restrictions and traditions. Adventurers who carved out their own way. I like people who get the joke being life. These are people like Hunter S. Thompson, Keith Richards, Falstaff, Ernest Hemingway, and the surfer Bunker Spreckles. Here's the thing. There are always people who bitch and moan about rules being broken and precedents being set. But the people who actually make history are the ones who give the world the middle finger. I've tried to live my life that way, by giving the finger instead of doing what's expected. And sometimes it works, and sometimes people get pissed, and I'm okay with that. I'm also not sure I'm making history, but I do have some great stories. I guess I'm writing this book to inspire you to get in on the joke and give someone the middle finger instead of doing what you're supposed to, within reason, of course. I was raised by Southern gentlemen and ladies, so I try to have manners, but my manners might be laced with a little whiskey-induced devilry from time to time. I'll tell you stories about women and wine and mushrooms. I'll talk about my dog, Little Craig. I'll regale you with insane travel tales and ridiculous work experiences that helped me figure out who I am not and that ultimately led me to Southern charm. Yes, I will talk about the show, but mainly I want to talk about living life off the leash, totally free to do whatever I want, even at 40. A life where setting average expectations for yourself is actually pretty glorious. Am I slowing down and contemplating a more traditional type of life? Maybe. Do I imagine settling down one day? We'll see. For now, I'm just here to show you a good time. I can promise that these stories will be wildly entertaining, because they're coming from a guy who got the Enthusiasm Award in the 4th grade. This was the same year I was cast, without even having to audition, I might add, as Tigger the Tiger in our school production of Winnie the Pooh. My only line was, "Bouncing is what Tigger does best." Even though I was typecast, it prepared me for my later one-liner as an ambulance driver in the Bruce Willis movie Reprisal. My line was, "When's the last time she ate?" The movie went straight to DVD. Besides my Enthusiasm Award, my Tigger role, and my intense need for freedom and escape as a toddler, the childhood incident that most predicted the trajectory of my adult life happened in the 7th grade. When Miss Sabo wrote a note to my parents on my report card that said, "Shep thinks he can get through 7th grade on charm alone, ... He doesn't have that much." And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Shepland. Chapter 1. not-so-humble beginnings. When I was kicking around potential titles for this book, I proposed and fought for a few. I was irrationally and a little jokingly telling the powers that be that when the book was published, I should be touted as the next Charles Dickens, the voice of a generation, a literary and creative force of nature. Dejected by their lack of enthusiasm, I said, fine, we'll call it Average Expectations, an obvious tip of the cap to the great Charles Dickens, but also an admission of defeat. But there's another layer to the title. Some would say a double entendre of sorts. Because the following is true. I come from a line that includes some amazingly accomplished and interesting people. I've been blessed to have family members who are war heroes, world travelers, captains of industry, famous socialites, jazz-age female golfers, friends of F. Scott Fitzgerald's, a federal judge, along with a slew of eccentric, strange, and hilarious relatives in the bunch. And then there's me, reality television booze hound and international Lothario. How proud everyone must be. If there's truly such a thing as rolling over in one's grave, I'm sure my ancestors are tied in knots by now. Whatever great expectations existed for me have been imploded over the years by my constant lowering of the bar. I never thought much about family name or placed much importance on it, but Lord knows in the South and in New England and in places like Palm Beach, it's like actual currency for some people. I have been interested to meet a Rockefeller or Vanderbilt or DuPont, mostly because it's American history, which is fascinating to me. Family names mean a great deal to some, but it's so shallow and silly. It does bother me when online trolls come at me by saying I inherited everything I have or making it seem like I should feel guilty because of my family and what they worked for. So, people who walk around trumpeting who they are and where they come from are ridiculous. But I also understand the irony of me dedicating a chapter to my amazing relatives. I'm just trying to give you some context and paint an interesting picture, damn it. For fun and a hint of pride and braggadocio, I now present to you a few branches of my family tree that prove that even though I may not be worthy of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, at least some of my relatives could be. My section at medieval times did win the whole jousting tournament once in Myrtle Beach, but that's probably not as impressive as actual war medals. Mom's side. Columbus Cummings. My great-great-great-grandfather was from New England, and he was one of seven children. He was told by his parents to go west when he was 20 years old, so he headed to Illinois. He was in the dry goods business, but then decided to go to southern Illinois, where he met his future wife, Sarah Mark. He opened a dry goods store of his own and did well, and in his spare time he got into farming with his in-laws. He was instrumental in developing the city of Pekin, Illinois. Then, in his 40s, he moved to Chicago, put a syndicate together to build the Nickel Plate Railroad that ran from Toledo to Cleveland to Chicago and down to St. Louis. He was president of the company and eventually sold the company to Cornelius Vanderbilt, of the Vanderbilts. Just thinking of his work ethic makes me want to take a long nap. Aunt Edith Cummings. Sister to my great-grandfather. I'll get to Papa in a second. Edith was so exceptional I decided to Google her so I wouldn't miss anything. Here's her Wikipedia bio. Edith Cummings Munson, popularly known as the Fairway Flapper, was an American socialite and one of the premier amateur golfers during the Jazz Age. She was one of the Big Four debutantes in Chicago during World War I. She attained fame in the United States following her 1923 victory at the U.S. Women's Amateur. On August 25, 1924, she became the first golfer and first female athlete to appear on the cover of Time magazine. She was also friendly with F. Scott Fitzgerald, and it's widely agreed that the character Jordan Baker from The Great Gatsby was based on Edith. So, you can see, definitely not average. Dexter Cummings, Papa. From Chicago, attended Yale, where he was the two-time NCAA champion golfer. His father, D. Mark Cummings, died when Papa was in his early 20s, so he quickly had to manage the family business and grow it, which he did with great success. He was an entrepreneur, financier, philanthropist, and great sportsman. Once his knees failed him, he focused on saltwater fishing. He had a yacht in Cuba called the Nicoya that was seized by Castro's new regime and appropriated by the Cuban Navy. Papa was once invited to Augusta National when it was first built, and his playing partner was the great Bobby Jones. Jones apparently was miffed that he was giving up so many strokes to an opponent. Papa supposedly said of that experience, "It didn't matter because I had lots of birdies that day and we won the match." He married Emily Hoyt, and they had three daughters, the oldest of which is my grandmother. They lived in Lake Forest, and my grandmother eventually attended Vassar, where she met my grandfather, Truman Hobbs. Judge Truman Hobbs. My grandfather Gramps was one of my favorite people in the world, and I'm not alone in that. You'd be hard-pressed to find a smarter, kinder, and funnier person who has ever lived. He grew up in Selma, Alabama, and his father was a U.S. senator. Gramps went to UNC Chapel Hill, where he was president of the student body and on the swim team. He was 6'5", so that helped. He then joined the Navy at the onset of World War II. He started as a salvage diver and did his practice diving in the East River in New York City. It was a little cleaner back then. He then rose to be the commander of a salvage ship. He was on both fronts during the war, was awarded the Navy and Marine Corps Medal and the Bronze Star. And he had so many crazy and funny stories from that time in life that my dad wrote a book chronicling his life. After the war, he attended Yale Law School, and that's when he met my grandmother, Nana. He applied to be a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court and got the job, under Justice Hugo Black. After a successful law career, he was nominated by President Jimmy Carter for a federal judgeship back in his native Alabama, where he served on the bench for 30 years. He and Nana had two girls and two boys, one of which is my mom. Hi, Mom. Two stories about Gramps I want to share because he was the best. When he was on a train coming back to Selma after 4 years of fighting in World War II, he knew his family was eagerly waiting, and this was especially true of his mother. So he was on the train and saw a young woman with a new baby in her arms. And he had an idea. He politely introduced himself to the woman and asked if she could kindly do him a favor. She asked what that might be. He requested that she walk off the train in Selma arm in arm with him while he carried her baby to mess with his family, especially his mom, and make them think he had gotten married and had a kid overseas without telling them. She happily complied. He was a charmer. And his poor mother fainted right there at the train depot. The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, and at least I take after him in some very important ways. And this story makes me emotional every time I think of it. When I was 14, Gramps was doing a crossword puzzle. He did the New York Times puzzle every day, definitely above average. And he asked me if I knew a four-letter word for paradise. Looking back, it was Eden. I immediately replied, home. I saw him tear up, and then so did I. He figured that was a pretty beautiful answer because it meant that he had raised a daughter who raised a son who equated home with paradise. After all the laughs and golf rounds, this story is what I remember the most. Dad's side. Southern Charm has covered how my family on my dad's side has deep roots in Boykin, South Carolina. The town is named after us, the Boykins. King George granted the land to a distant, like really distant, relative in the late 1700s. They called it Boykin, and the clan grew from there. There are so many different cousins, uncles, and aunts it can make your head spin. One cool fun fact is that my ancestors were big duck hunters, but the Labradors they used to fetch the ducks were capsizing the boats they were sitting in. So they created a breed called the Boykin Spaniel, and the breed became the state dog of South Carolina. Camden, South Carolina is right next door and became a horse racing and horse farm mecca early in the 20th century, which brought some big money and prestige to the area, which was mostly all about farming before that point. The horse racing scene brought partiers from New York and beyond to this small farming town, and apparently there were some radical parties in Camden and Boykin back in the day, which is how my grandparents and then my parents actually met. Papa, yes, another papa. My dad's dad was named Bill Rose. His family owned and ran a huge cypress mill in Perry, Florida. His father died at the young age of 54, so Papa moved to Jacksonville, Florida with his sister, attended prep schools like the Bowles School and then Phillips Exeter, then went to Cornell University. After his second year, he joined World War II in the services of the U.S. Army under none other than General George Patton. Papa became a sergeant in a tank division and fought and helped win the Battle of the Bulge. It was while in Europe that he made up his mind that he wanted to come back and become an international businessman. He returned to Cornell, got his degree in economics, and joined Armco Steel out of Middletown, Ohio. His willingness to travel sent him first to Paris for a spell and then to Genoa, Italy. My dad grew up in Italy during his formative years, and that's where he got his nickname that stuck for the rest of his life, Rip Rose, named after Rip Van Winkle, who slept for 20 years straight. His Italian nannies had never seen anyone sleep so much. Again, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My dad's family eventually came back to Boykin and built a house on my grandmother's family land, and that's where Papa and Dad taught me to hunt, fish, and get cars stuck in the mud. That last one was self-taught, actually. I still go there today and love running into Boykins all over the state. Great Uncle Richard Dixie Boykin. A very interesting, colorful character. My dad described him this way. He wasn't in the movies or anything, but he was definitely an entertainer. Big personality. When all the wealthy industrialists from New York came down to the horse farms and parties in Camden in the winter, Dixie was the guy they all sent a telegram to, basically saying, please prepare for our arrival and set up some big, extravagant parties. He was a local bon vivant, essentially, and a party facilitator. For some reason, I'm picturing the jolly guy in Moulin Rouge who runs the cabaret. Anyway, in the 1930s, he went out to Hollywood and tried to break into the motion picture business with varying degrees of success. And he became friends with classic screen star Tallulah Bankhead. Dixie had a friend called Max Ferguson from a wealthy Philadelphia family. At the time, gasoline was rationed and scarce. It was hard to farm without gasoline-powered machinery, so it was Dixie's idea to look into getting an elephant to plow the fields instead of a horse or a mule. He heard of a circus that was going out of business in Atlanta, so he and Max went down there and purchased Alice the elephant. They arranged to put Alice on a train to Camden. When Alice arrived, much of the town was on horseback, and it was a bustling Saturday. When the elephant was unloaded, the horses and mules and most of the people had never seen one, and the animals freaked out and caused a stampede through town. Everyone was upset. So, a law was passed that still stands today in Camden. No elephants are allowed to be delivered to the train station on Saturdays. This experience rightly taught him that elephants, horses, and mules generally don't get along. They also had trouble getting people to guide and work Alice in the field, so Alice became a pet. The 8,000-pound elephant in the corner of the room, to the great delight of many around Camden. A couple of years later, they sold Alice back to the same circus, which had reformed. Finally, my family tree would not be complete without Rip and Fran, my parents, who have put up with me for over 40 years. Rip and Fran Rose, married over 48 years, I hold my dad in as high esteem as Gramps, and I'm also not alone in that. We are nothing alike, though. My dad told me he got so drunk once in college that he didn't drink again for 3 months. What a rookie. He's thoughtful, cautious, a great listener, and very calm and deliberate. He's also one of the fairest and most decent people you'll ever meet, and he loves silly jokes and movies like The Naked Gun. He worked in the Reagan administration in the tax division, then moved to Hilton Head and spent most of his professional life with the same law firm as a tax and corporate attorney. I give him a hard time. All dads should be given a hard time. We have lots of lively banter. We argue about politics. We go on amazing fishing trips around the world. Love you, Dad. My mom is more like me. She can talk and theorize all day and night and loves a good party. Dad actually likes a good party too, his college sabbatical notwithstanding. She is also basically solely responsible for raising me and my two siblings. She did everything. Schools, practices, making us study and write thank you notes, cooking dinner, challenging us mentally, organizing all holidays and family trips, taking us to the emergency room, in my case a lot, and much, much more. She is truly the person who makes me think that home is paradise. Love you, Mom. Shep approves Southern traditions. While I am not an authority on being a Southern gentleman, I was reared in the South, so I know a thing or two. Many of the traditions should go the way of Betamax tapes and the guillotine, but some are okay. Here are a few that I think every man should abide by. Number one, never ask a woman her age at a party, and definitely do not ask a woman if she's pregnant. I made this mistake once before, and I'm still mortified. Number two, hold the door open. It's a simple gesture, but it's a small display of humanity and courtesy, and these days we can use as much of that as we can get. Number three, let people over in traffic. Like any place, the South has their fair share of asshole drivers, but far less so than in the Northeast and Florida and Los Angeles. By the way, Florida and Texas are not the South. They're their own entities. Come at me if you must. Number four, saying darling and honey and sweetie to everyone you meet. I wondered about this tradition after the Me Too movement. I even tweeted about it after a nice older lady at an airport Burger King gave me a burger and said, "Have a good day, honey." I replied, "You too, darling." Afterward, I polled the internet and almost everyone agreed that if initiated with a playfulness by, typically, the woman, it is uniquely Southern and totally acceptable to say things like darling. And thank goodness, because it's a tradition I love. Number five, standing when a lady comes to a table, helping her into her coat and pulling out a chair. I'm not always the best at this because I get excited, distracted, and I forget. But it's a nice, quaint thing, and my mom likes it. And women should be treated with more reverence than men. They run the world, after all. Or at least they should. Number six. Saying yes, ma'am, no, sir, to elders. I still do this in most situations. Respect is never a bad thing to offer unless the elder is a jerk, in which case you can nix this rule. Number seven. Cotillion dance classes. I was thrown out of mine at age 12 for borrowing a girl's white gloves and slapping my friends across the face with them. But I did learn the foxtrot, so there's that. Chapter 2. In on the joke. Despite my family tree, expectations in life were fairly low for me, which is a hell of a good position to be in. I mean, the potential was always there. I showed glimmers of excellence, but those glimmers were always quickly washed away by waves of tomfoolery. I followed a traditional path of graduating high school and going to college and then business school, but I never sought out a traditional life. I've been too busy seeking out a good time, which is a lifestyle choice that has a way of leading you to detours and potholes and epic hangovers instead of promotions and corporate expense accounts. Instead of sitting at a desk in a suit, I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt on TV, and it's considered work. Well, it is by some. I never imagined that I'd be where I am, but was it my destiny? How did the patient zero of Ritalin, favorite class is recess kid, grow up to be on a reality TV show for 6 seasons and counting? I'll try to explain. Remember the heartbreaking scene in Forrest Gump when his mother is dying and they have a rudimentary conversation about free will and one's path in life? Forrest asks, "What is my destiny, Mama?" And she replies, "You're going to have to figure that out for yourself." Forrest's destiny leads him to become a star ping pong player, a decorated soldier, a long-distance runner, a shrimping boat captain, and husband of Jenny and dad to little Forrest. My destiny, on the other hand, led me to Southern Charm. I'm pretty decent at ping pong, but that's where the Gump similarities begin and end. That and we're both Southern, but that's pretty much it. I'm not comparing myself to a hero like Forrest Gump, but who on earth could have predicted I'd land where I am now? Just like who on earth could have predicted that Forrest would become a valiant soldier carrying Bubba away from enemy fire and getting shot in the buttocks? But once upon a time, about 8 years ago, when the show called Southern Charm was conceived, my destiny came calling. Here's how it happened. Between your first and second years of business school, you're expected to get a summer internship. For a while, I had worked for golfer entrepreneur Greg Norman's real estate development company in West Palm Beach. More on my laundry list of jobs later. I had given an Australian businessman named David Spencer a tour of some of our real estate projects, and we hit it off, bullshitting and laughing, two of my specialties, throughout the whole tour. Later on, when I was thinking about my summer internship, I reached out to David to see if he knew of anything. At the time, he was running a company in Dubai, so he arranged for me to spend a summer working there and partying because it's all about balance. Life lesson here. If you sense someone is a like-minded soul, don't miss the opportunity to break the ice and stay in contact. You never know how far they might go in life. I love my time in Dubai. More on that later. And when it was over, I was offered to return on a permanent basis for a nice salary. My destiny was to become an international businessman. It was the dream. At least it was my dad's dream for me. You see, he grew up in Italy and France because his dad was in the international steel business. So really, all my travels have been enthusiastically supported by my dad. I love him for many reasons, but I'm most thankful for his go-see-the-world spirit and support. It has meant everything to me because learning about other people and cultures infinitely opens one's mind. Anyway, I returned to the U.S. with my chest out, bragging to everyone that I had a job lined up in Dubai. My dad was excited for me. My mom could finally stop worrying. As much as a mother cannot worry as their wild-ass son heads to the land of Sharia law for an unspecified amount of time. Life was good. I had just a few more months of school and then I was off to the Middle East, the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, the Tigris and Euphrates. I think these are all in the same vicinity. Who knows? I was going to Dubai. But then, kind of like Forrest Gump, destiny hit me in the ass. October 2008 came along, a financial crisis happened, the economy crashed, and the party was over all around the world. Dubai was hit hard because it was predicated on foreign investment and real estate speculation, and overnight the faucet was simply turned off. The company that hired me certainly wasn't worried about a second-year American business school student calling in to check if his offer was still on the table. Everyone there was holding on for dear life. I remember hearing stories about people just leaving their Range Rovers at the Dubai airport and heading back to wherever they came from, never to return. A few of the guys I knew were actually threatened to be arrested if they ever returned, since the locals were blaming them for the downfall of civilization. I heard through the grapevine that the royal family in Dubai was starting to blame the Western businessmen for risking their sovereign fund on development, which was bullshit. They were arm in arm with the West and wanting to create a paradise in the desert. But this isn't about the Dubai royal family or a global economic crisis. Small potatoes. This is about me. I was out of a job and my future and the future of my classmates was suddenly in limbo. So, like many people at the time, I moved home and tried to figure out my next move. I was stuck at my parents' house with about 10 college degrees, give or take. I was overeducated and undermotivated. Well, it wasn't that I was undermotivated, it was that companies weren't motivated to hire anyone. This is where my thankfulness and gratitude kick in for being born into a family with means, because I didn't have crushing student loans like so many people. There's a lot of wealth in Hilton Head where I grew up, but like anywhere, you see disparities. I know I'm fortunate, but I'm also thankful. I don't feel guilty about who and where I come from, though. The only things I feel guilty about are the stupid things I've done, most of which I'm divulging in great detail, as you will hear in this audiobook. So, yes, I was anxious about what I was going to do with my life, but I also didn't have a bank or a university with its hand out wanting a payment, with interest. I was living in Hilton Head Island where I grew up. It's a place I can drive around blindfolded, not that I've tried, and that I love dearly, but it's not exactly where you want to be if you're trying to start a career. I mean, yes, there's tourism during the summers. The population goes from 40,000 to 200,000 from winter to summer, but it's like Groundhog Day. Same people, same places, every single day. I really don't mind that lifestyle, and I almost prefer it at times. You see, I love walking into a place and knowing a handful of people right off the bat. That's why I'll never understand the allure of a place like New York City, where you're surrounded by strangers at all times. That's not a lifestyle I seek. I know they say familiarity breeds contempt, but I think whoever said that must have had really annoying friends. That's why I think Charleston is the perfect place to live. It's not too big and not too small. You can go places and see familiar faces and maybe also meet someone new every now and then. But back to Hilton Head Island. As soon as I moved there, my best friend Andrew moved from LA, and so did a handful of old buddies. We had an amazing crew, and nobody was married, so we wreaked havoc on that small island. One friend had a house near the beach, and we would have epic beach days, pounding beers in the sun and grilling out and just trying to one-up each other. I'll always cherish those times. I even briefly dated a cop. Here's the story. I lost my cell phone one night when we were out, And so the next day I asked a friend to call my phone, and a female cop answered. I went to go meet her, and wouldn't you know it, she was hot. She was a hot cop. I was still a little drunk, so I started flirting with her. She said her partner had my phone, so I said, well, you should call it. She did, and I was like, now I have your number. Pretty slick, flirting with the law. After a month of back and forth PG-13 texts, she was a decorated officer after all, I took her out. Things went well and we hooked up, but after our second date, she broke up with me. She said I was too immature and that I asked about the contents of the evidence room way too much. It's a damn shame. I'd truly be invincible if I were still sleeping with the law. I did manage to write a business plan during that time that involved raising money to buy distressed homes and waiting until the market returned to sell them. I bought an oceanfront condo at a bankruptcy auction and fixed it up, but the business plan went nowhere. First of all, everyone was struggling, and also, who in their right mind would give me a bunch of money to invest? Plus, I've always hated sales and asking people for anything, so it just wasn't going to happen. At this point, I was holding on to the hope that my dad's friend's advice that life doesn't matter before you're 30 was true. During this time, I was also going to visit friends around the country to see what they were up to and see what the hell might be out there job-wise. I remember wanting to make something happen in San Francisco, but nothing materialized. One weekend when I was in Atlanta, I went to a fast casual Asian restaurant, think Chipotle, but with rice and noodle bowls. I love Asian food in general, and I love this restaurant, so much so that I got inspired to ask for the owner's name at the counter. Before I knew it, I was trying to become a franchisee of a tin drum restaurant. At the same time, I was working on another franchise deal that had me traveling from Hilton Head to Charleston to look for retail space, and of course, have a little fun. That's when everything changed. The date my destiny shifted, again, was New Year's Eve 2012. I was at a rooftop party in Charleston during one of these trips, and I spotted Thomas Ravenel. He was a Charleston businessman and politician before he was cast on Southern Charm, allowing him to add reality TV star to his illustrious resume. Thomas lived across the street from my uncle, and we were acquaintances. We later actually discovered that we were distant cousins, which isn't that unusual in South Carolina. Perhaps nowadays, a 23andMe DNA test should be required before any Southern wedding, because you never know. At the rooftop party, I asked Thomas what he was up to, and he said a guy named Whitney from Los Angeles was in town filming a docuseries about his life in Charleston. Almost on cue, Whitney Sudler Smith walked across the roof and asked if I knew where any chicks were. I said, sure, and then I gave him my go-to business card at the time, which consisted of the picture of a guy punching another guy in the balls with the words, go fuck yourself. It seems he liked my card because we've been fast friends ever since. That night, Whitney explained that his mom had just moved to Charleston from New York, and while he was visiting her, he observed via some dinner parties that Charleston had a lot of genuine, offbeat, and interesting characters. He said he was in the TV business and he thought the city might be ripe for a TV show celebrating and investigating these colorful Southern characters. I guess I fit the bill because after meeting me on the rooftop, he said that he and his business partner would like to buy me lunch and talk. We ended up having a hilarious and boozy lunch, and he offered to put me on the show, which is funny since I was very against reality TV at the time. He needed to put together a sizzle reel first, basically a trailer that convinces Hollywood execs to buy an idea. So I told him we could go to my family's farm with a bunch of friends and have some fun, build a fire, shoot some skeet, and drink some whiskey. Pretty standard evening on the farm. We ended up having a blast and getting a taxi to a strip club outside of Columbia, South Carolina, which is always a good idea. After that, I thought I'd never hear from those guys again. Chalk the experience up to my I'll try anything once philosophy. Not that I had never been to a strip club before, but I had never taken someone who had offered me a job to a strip club, though it seemed logical at the moment. In case you're wondering, there is footage of that fateful night out there somewhere, but what the hell? If it leaks, it leaks. It's not like I have aspirations to become a politician or a priest. I actually hated the footage I saw from that night at the farm. I was trying really hard to be provocative and devil may care, but I ended up sounding like a dilettante. Some may argue that I am a dilettante, but I have since learned to play my cards closer to the chest, mostly. Looking back, I actually learned a valuable lesson from that experience. Don't try too hard in front of the camera, because the camera never lies, and even a casual observer can see through the charade. After that crazy night, I went back to work on the franchise deal I had been focused on. I didn't think about the show at all. Well, maybe a little. I figured it was just some Hollywood guy doing what they do best, bullshitting you into believing they're working on something big and taking you with them. Well, 6 months later, I got a call from a manager in LA who said he was friends with Whitney and that Bravo loved the show and that he would be sending me a contract to sign. They said they loved how much of an unabashed nitwit I was on camera. It's painful to think about how cocky I acted at the time, but I had oversold that mystical place of mine called Shepland, which I guess caught the interest of the denizens of La La Land. I suppose they'd never seen such brazen idiocy. Again, this is why I learned to hold things closer to the vest. Maybe the lesson is, act like a dumbass, and then when you get their attention, you try to rein it in. Disclaimer: this advice does not apply to bankers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, business people, accountants, or teachers. More unsolicited yet valuable advice: when someone in Hollywood says they're sending you a contract, sit back and open a few 12-packs and a handle of bourbon, because the process takes forever. What followed after that call was 6 months of back and forth between forces more knowledgeable than myself. Frankly, I wasn't all that bullish on the idea in the first place. That may be somewhat hard to reconcile, given the fact that I've been on Southern Charm for so long. But I was always the snob who scoffed at reality TV. I even scoffed at brainless movies like The Fast and the Furious and Transformers. Of course, I had absolutely no basis for my condescension. But I like the Coen brothers and Wes Anderson and shows written by Aaron Sorkin. Dark shit that was about as far away from popcorn entertainment as you could get. To become what I despised, and for no good reason, gave me pause. But not that much pause. I mean, there I was, a 33-year-old business school graduate in the middle of becoming a franchisee of a Tin Drum restaurant out of Atlanta, a deal that had just taken a turn for the worse. And here's where Gump's mom's voice comes in. I was humming along with my deal with the Atlanta folks, and the rug was pulled out from underneath me at the one-yard line. So is fate a thing? Certainly seems like it sometimes. When that deal fell through, I was pretty much open to anything. There was also a part of me that knew I could make people laugh and bring some joie de vivre to the table. I had secretly harbored a desire to do stand-up comedy in college. But to think it and then actually get up there and crack jokes are two separate things, especially when no one you know is going that route. Remember, I was brought up in a world of traditional Southern expectations, and the University of Georgia, where I went to college, was a place where people, at least the people I hung out with, very much followed those expectations, and stand-up comedy definitely did not fit into this. I mean, sure, Athens has a cool and hip artistic vibe, and my friends and I were insane and we partied harder than anyone. But then we went to economics and finance class the next day. I know it sounds like I'm making up excuses for why I didn't have the balls to get on a comedy stage, and I kind of am. But compare my world back then to someone like Jonah Hill, who grew up in Los Angeles and had Adam Levine from Maroon 5 as his best friend. In that scene, anything seemed possible to me. Rob Reiner's close friend was the actor, director, comedian Albert Brooks. And Rob's dad was Carl Reiner, one of the greatest comedians of all time. Supposedly, Carl thought little Albert was great when he had birthday parties for Rob, and that's how things got started for him. In Hilton Head Island, though, my best friend as a kid was Andrew Carmines, and his parents owned the popular Hilton Head restaurant Hudson Seafood, and now Andrew runs it today. It's amazing, by the way. The point is, famous people in California lived a different world, and I lived in the South, where connections could only get you a corner office or a seafood restaurant. But a comedy career? Hell no. Since this world was so foreign to me, and because I was still a highbrow snob who thought reality shows had as much integrity and creative merit as a Long John Silver's, I asked all my friends and family what I should do. I got a lot of varying responses, many of them negative and some positive. The people who initially told me not to do it have since come back and admitted how wrong they were, which is always validating. But there is one answer that sticks with me to this day and makes me feel like maybe in some ways that I, Shep Rose, am actually a little bit like a real-life Forrest Gump. When I asked my mom whether or not I should do the show, she said, "Shep, you should have been on TV years ago." Unlike Forrest's mom, my mom knew her son's destiny. Despite her enthusiasm, though, I did have to figure it out on my own. I ended up saying yes, obviously, but I definitely had some major hesitation. How can you not listen to and consider the reservations that many of your friends have about a big life decision? The one thing I wanted to know was, can I somehow walk away if I feel like a shit show is occurring? The answer was sort of. Basically, I decided that it was worth it, and from the start, it turned out to actually be fun. We were off to the races. The only thing we didn't know was how people would react when they watched it. But I remember several times when we were shooting the first season thinking, this is one funny shit show. So here I am. I followed my destiny from the kid who was crowned most enthusiastic in elementary school, on to college, then to business school and Dubai, and on to a Charleston rooftop, and eventually to Southern Charm. Or maybe I didn't follow it. Maybe I just stumbled around and said yes when opportunity knocked. Because if I'm anything, I'm curious. I'm always up for whatever. And I'm willing to try anything at least once. I guess that's my business plan. Yes, I used to scoff at reality TV. But you know who else scoffs at reality TV? People who never anteed up in life. And people who don't get the joke. What's funny is that I've met a handful of celebrities in the last few years. And the ones who look down their nose at you for being on reality TV are the ones whose career maybe isn't where they want it to be, or they're struggling and a bit insecure. The bigger the star, the more interested and gracious and curious they are about what it is I do and how everything works, basically how the sausage is made. Besides, why should I feel bad about being on a reality show? I never set out to be Daniel Day-Lewis. I just wanted to be Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes, and in many ways, I'm succeeding. I've put a lot of thought into the pros and cons of being in a reality show over the years, and after much soulful contemplation, and after meeting all sorts of fans and attending a crazy and wonderful event called BravoCon in the fall of 2019, I've come to this conclusion. We amuse people and take them away for a bit, and that's the only goal of entertainment. People finish work for the day, and they have a long commute home. They make dinner for their kids and put them to sleep. Then they turn on Bravo, and they're brought into our crazy world for an hour. And it's a much-needed escape. Did the Southern Charm cast all pay our dues toiling away in theater and going on auditions and dealing with rejection and heartbreak in Hollywood? No. We took other paths that were filled with different hardships. Well, actually, Shep Land has been pretty good. I admit that I was wrong years ago to scoff. It was about me, not the genre. Because being able to give people a release in the form of happiness or heartache or drunken debauchery is an honor. And no more was I aware of this than at BravoCon. The fans were so enthusiastic and happy to see us. I felt like a Beatle, minus the musical talent. There was just support out the wazoo, and it really drove some things home for all of us. Like the fact that we need to appreciate where destiny has taken us because of the fans and the support we receive. But also, because that place includes guys with black suits holding a sign with our name on it at LaGuardia Airport, which leads to a Mercedes parked on the curb, ready to take us to a hotel suite in Manhattan. It's insane. And don't get me started on all the free clothes. Admittedly, before Southern Charm, I was always calculating how much money I needed and how much or little I needed to do in order to just exist and to have some fun, obviously. Is that lack of ambition or total Buddha-like enlightenment? I guess I never figured I was going to be that guy with the jet and four houses, nor did I really think that was necessary, although it does sound badass. I'm the guy who, even if he can afford a beachfront property, wants the house one street behind, since the wear and tear of the salt air and flood insurance are insufferable. I'm also the guy whose cell phone is never under 20%, but never over 80. When it charges over 80%, I feel like I'm overworking the phone and it needs to take a break. I'm practical and pragmatic, if nothing else. It's a great source of pride that for generations my family has done very well, and it's covered on the show to a certain extent. But I'm also pretty wary of it. There's a saying that rich screams and wealth whispers, and I was always taught to whisper, so talking about it is something I'm very allergic to, but here goes. My dad's family had a town named after them here in South Carolina, and they were granted the land by King George II in the late 1700s. My mom's family built the railroads in Chicago, on her mom's side, and her dad's dad played football at Vanderbilt and became a U.S. Senator out of Selma, Alabama. I guess one way of putting it is that there's a bit of cushion that exists for me. My parents and grandparents were always very careful not to mention it or glorify it. We never had nice cars or garish toys, but we knew the cushion was there. What I tried to figure out along the way was this. What could I do professionally that's respectable but not too strenuous so that I could just travel and have fun and be comfortable and live the life of a benevolent pirate inspired by Hemingway or Jimmy Buffett? Basically, my goals have long been surf, fish, drink, and laugh. Please don't confuse this with the mantra like eat, pray, and love or live, laugh, and love or whatever people stitch on pillows. I don't need a surf, drink, fish, laugh pillow unless Craig's company is willing to make it. The point is, I've been living this life for a long time, and honestly, it just never gets old. Maybe one day I'll wake up just before noon and say, enough. I wouldn't mind a more sedentary life eventually, but thus far, it hasn't come close to happening. I've also been blessed, or cursed, by the fact that I just don't get hungover. I do love to sleep, so that's my vice after a bender. But I'm ready to go again at a moment's notice. Like I said, it's either a blessing or a curse. I'm going with blessing. I get a lot of flack on social media from angry people who like to lash out at me, saying things like, you never worked a day in your life, your parents bankroll your life, you've never lifted a finger. Insert whatever expletives you'd like. All these things are false, as you will soon see. Long before anyone cared enough to assassinate my character via social media, people would say that I was part of the Lucky Sperm Club, which is funny but definitely not a compliment. Yes, by the wonders of nature, luck, destiny, or whatever you want to call it, I was born into a nice and comfortable situation. It could have been worse, but it's not like I murdered someone or made a pact with the devil. I had it good, but it's not like I grew up on a yacht or got a private jet when I turned 16. I wasn't a billionaire like Bruce Wayne, but I might be Batman. No one can prove that I'm not. I've generally had to work my entire adult life, with varying degrees of success. My parents wouldn't have had it any other way. I'm 100% sure I could not sit on my ass and live a full life foregoing all income. That isn't and never was an option. What's funny to me and my castmates, Craig in particular, is when social media so-called fans get on our case about being lazy or not contributing to society. Most of us also have other jobs or projects outside of the show, like Craig and his pillows. So it's not like we're a bunch of freeloaders ruining humanity by appearing on a show about Charleston. As I keep saying, people really need to have a beer, delete the tweet, and get in on the joke. Their lives would be so much more enjoyable. Unfortunately, though, if I'm in a mood, I engage with the trolls and fight back. It's stupid, but it can also be fun. It's not like they're hard to outsmart, but it's like shouting into an abyss. It's a no-win situation, so I try not to engage. I'm only human, though. As far as contributing to society, I understand that the Southern Charm Cast isn't out there curing a disease. But like I mentioned before, we entertain and distract people, which is a form of public service. Also, I pay my taxes. I don't harm anyone in society, so what on earth is wrong with what we do or who we are? Would you rather that I graduated from business school, gone to work for Goldman Sachs, and become perversely incentivized to sell toxic assets to your grandparents? What if I was head of marketing for Philip Morris? Would that validate me? Celebrities are always told to shut up and stay in their lane, meaning don't talk about politics or society or anything meaningful, really. I'm a literate, discerning, well-intentioned citizen with full voting rights, so what lane should I drive in? This is my fucking lane. Should a cashier also stay in their lane? Retail talk only, damn it. I happen to have been placed in a good position, and I'm just trying to enjoy the view. Stopping and smelling the roses is a priority for me, and it's a hell of a lot of fun to boot. Why should I apologize for that? But just in case you still hate me, here's a list of jobs I've had that will maybe validate my existence in your mind. Or maybe they'll make you hate me even more. It's a toss-up. Sailing instructor / rental associate. I begin with my all-time favorite job. God, I loved it. It was at the end of high school, and one of my best friends and I would meet at the dock on the southern tip of Hilton Head Island at 8 a.m. The start time was my least favorite part. and the owner of Commander Zodiac would meet us there. He did dolphin sighting tours, and he was an avid sailor and a good guy. Every morning, we'd teach up to 10 kids the basics of sailing a little sailfish sailboat. The kids were great, and we'd take them over to a barrier island and explore, basically killing a few hours so their parents could explore the bars and restaurants. Well, that's what I would do. In the afternoons, we'd sit around, smoke a huge joint, and wait for someone to walk by and ask to go on a tour. Hey, I said I've had a ton of jobs. I never said they were grueling. Besides, we provided community service for every girl who walked by. We invited them to parties later that night and give them an excuse to ditch their parents. One day, I spotted a very attractive girl walking along the water, and as I was talking to her, I noticed her legs were hairier than mine. And at that moment, I discovered an important life skill, the importance of being quick on your feet with a lie. When she asked for my number, I changed the final digit just as her legs came into focus. Hairy legs were not my thing, still aren't, and I didn't want to waste her time or mine. I can't put that life skill on a resume, but it does come in handy. We were all a deep purple shade of tan by the end of the summer. We looked like walking eggplants with white hair. At the end of the summer, we went to a Widespread Panic concert and accidentally, on purpose, ate 5 hits of acid each, and somehow ended up locked in a girl's dad's study, where we discovered a book covered in tinfoil called Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis, which my friends and I still laugh about to this day. Maybe I should actually read the thing now that I'm in my 40s. Busboy. My mom's full-time job during the summers when I was a teenager was to make sure that I was looking for a job. All I wanted to do was surf, build bike ramps, and play basketball. My mom made all my meals and I lived at home, so why did I need a job? Every summer, I would half-heartedly look for work in June. I'd turn in a few resumes, go back to playing basketball, and by July, my mom would usually have given up on me, helplessly watching me and my pothead friends do backflips on BMX bikes into our pool. I'm sure it was very pleasant and relaxing for her. One summer, probably to spare herself 3 months of anxiety, she made sure to secure a job for me at her friend's restaurant, Truffles, as a busboy. It wasn't ideal for me, since I usually create messes, not fix them. The one thing I did like about the job was the bread and boursin cheese that they served. That boursin was like crack to me, so you could usually find me in the kitchen with the dishwashers munching on bread and cheese trying to make solid weed connections. As you can probably guess, I was unceremoniously let go, and I happily went back to terrorizing the neighborhood and organizing parties. Well, not organizing per se, that requires too much effort, but attending parties for sure. Pizza deliverer. When I was 19 years old, I came home from college for the summer, and this time I actually had to get a job. Since I wasn't a high schooler being supported by mom and dad, money started to become a necessity for staples like beer, and the various things you need to score chicks, drinks, dinners, the occasional game of pool, mushroom tea, corsages, ping pong balls, laughing gas, yo-yos, parachutes, neck braces, etc. A guy a little older than me was running a pizza place called Da Vinci's Pizza, and he liked me, so he hired me as a delivery boy. I liked this job. I drive around and make people happy by bringing them food. That was the job description. I worked from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., and when I met up with my buddies, I had about $60 in my pocket. The problem was that I would always forget to check the order, so I would forget a 2-liter Sprite or some extra breadsticks, and customers would get pissed. A man can't master every profession, though, so I give myself a solid 6 for this one. Expediter. This is the job that redeemed me. It was at the Mangy Moose restaurant in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The Moose is actually a famous steak joint and music venue at the base of